This is Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, your daily voice in Washington, D.C. on the issues of faith, family, and freedom. And now, here's your host, Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Well, good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to Washington Watch. Coming up, President-elect Trump is steadily filling his cabinet with mostly solid conservative picks. Ken Blackwell, a member of the transition team, joins me with an update in just a moment. And you know the federal government is wasting your money, but you don't know the half of it. Oklahoma Senator James Lankford is here to give us the details on the latest federal waste book. Also, the latest from Israel and how the Israelis view the election of Donald Trump to president, with New York Times bestselling author Joel Rosenberg, who'll join me here in studio. And as promised, we'll have an expert on election law and the Electoral College help us separate fact from fiction. Dr. Gary Gregg from the University of Louisville is here, so we'll talk about that a little bit later on Washington Watch. The website, TonyPerkins.com. If you're on Twitter, it's at TPerkins. Okay. President-elect Trump's cabinet continues to take shape, the latest picks being Georgia Congressman Tom Price, who has been a leading opponent of Obamacare. He's a physician. He's been tapped to head up the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and it has the left going crazy. Trump is also said to be ready to name Elaine Chao as Transportation Secretary. What does all this mean? Is it a solidly conservative cabinet? What distinctions do we see here from previous Republican cabinets? Well, leading domestic policy expert for the Trump transition team and senior fellow for human rights and constitutional governance here at the Family Research Council, and former Ohio Secretary of State, our own Ken Blackwell joins us for the conversation. Ken, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Hey, Tony, it's good to be with you. It's an exciting time, and I'm glad to have a front row seat as I watch the president-elect put together his team through what I consider to be a comprehensive and unique process of vetting.
What do you mean, front row seat? You're in the arena, man.
I didn't want to say that because I didn't want the left to take any unnecessary shots at me.
Hey, you stick around with me, you're going to get shots, man.
I know that.
Look, one of the key centerpieces of the Trump campaign was to repeal and replace Obamacare. Dr. Tom Price has been not just a critic of Obamacare, he's been leading the fight against Obamacare, even proposing a replacement plan, which he lectured on here at the Family Research Council. I mean, what does this say about Donald Trump's intentions when it comes to Obamacare?
Well, I think in a general sense, what he wants to establish early on is promises made, promises kept. And he knows that a real socialist type system that Obamacare represents is detrimental to quality medicine as well as individual and family control over a very crucial basket of choices that they can make in their lives. So he turns to Congressman Price, who is not only a physician, but somebody who has worked through the Congress, you know, a real replacement to Obamacare, and he's tackled him. He's chosen him to tackle the problem of moving forward very quickly with it. He's respected in the House. And he's respected in the Senate. So I think we have a unique chance to getting something done, which will send a real signal to the American public that they, in fact, made a choice and a candidate who will be president that will paint in what Reagan called bold colors, not pastels.
Well, the other aspect about Tom Price is not only has he been a leading critic of Obamacare, putting together his own replacement plan, been a part of House leadership. He was the Republican Study Committee chairman. I was communicating with him last night and again this morning, congratulating him on his pick. But he's also a solidly pro-life legislator. He's got a 100% rating with the Family Research Council. And this, of course, is causing a collective spin around of heads on the left when they see that Donald Trump is actually doing what he said he was going to do.
Absolutely. You know, we've been working on his first 100 days, and that's going to make the statement and set the standard for his first term as president of the United States. He has been given a brilliant opportunity, and I think what he's doing is he's mending fences. He's pulling the party together around not only promises, but brilliant opportunities we have to govern and lead Americans and return power back to the people. Every day you talk to someone in leadership position on the transition team, they remind one another that he won this election by saying to people who the left regard as residents of flyover country that they matter, that this is a government of, by, and for the people. And he, in fact, has said throughout the campaign that he represents them. He represents their interests. He represents a return to the governance by, you know, those who, in fact, are governed by the system.
So
back to the people and families.
He is the president for what the left considers the deplorables. In other words, the flyover company, those that still believe in traditional values. You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. Ken Blackwell, my guest, discussing the latest cabinet picks from President-elect Donald Trump. Let me just a couple more aspects on Tom Price, and it goes back to something you just said. That he's picking somebody who reflects the promises made. Promises made, promises kept. What was he in the Georgia congressman? He has been the chairman for the last 6 years of the House Budget Committee and has been leading the charge to topple President Obama's signature failure known as Obamacare. In fact, he was one of the principal authors of the reconciliation bill a year ago that defunded Planned Parenthood and gutted Obamacare, made it through the House, through the Senate, landed on President Obama's desk, and it was vetoed. So there's no question whatsoever where he stands on Obamacare. Again, a central discussion item, a focal point of the Trump campaign. Now, let me jump over, Ken Blackwell, to the Secretary of State. A lot of back and forth controversy over this pick going on now for several days because Mitt Romney is said to be in the running. John Bolton said to be in the running. Even Rudy Giuliani said to be a possible pick for that. That's been going on now for almost 2 weeks. And some of the concern, and I've expressed it myself about Mitt Romney, like him, supported him when he was the Republican nominee. But when you talk about the promises made by Donald Trump in the campaign, a lot of his discussion was on foreign policy, making America great again, not apologizing for who we are, making those who benefit from our presence help pull the wagon. That doesn't strike me as a job that Mitt Romney can do.
And I think that what the president-elect and his team is trying to do is to say, look, his style is to create a principal team of rivals. And I mean, he wants to really vet these candidates. But in doing that, he's also allowed for some transparency when it comes to those on the team that have serious reservations and keen memories about what was said, not just early on in the campaign, But what was said all the way through the campaign, what was funded throughout the campaign,
right.
And as a consequence, you know, it is, on the one hand, it is a sign that he is listening to all the voices, even those who objected to him. But on the other hand, it violates one of the principles that he is noted for, and that is that this guy will dance with those who bring him. And he, in fact, made a keen observation when he recognized that he is true and loyal to those folks who are loyal to the principles and the programs and the ideas that he advanced through thick and thin. And so he really doesn't want to send the wrong signal to the base. And
right.
So that's why this is fascinating to watch. I'm sure people will circle the wagons and get behind the president, but I like the fact that he has invited the sort of scrutiny of his potential picks from the folks who send him to the dance.
Well,
that's the American people.
Yeah, I certainly give him credit from the standpoint, and I'm not so. I mean, yes, it's an issue that Mitt Romney not only opposed him in the primary, but was aggressively opposing him in the general election. But I actually think that speaks to Donald Trump in his, he's magnanimous in the fact that he is willing to entertain appointing or nominating, someone who is a chief rival of his. I mean, I think that shows that he's willing to sit down and have conversations. That's an admirable trait, quite frankly. However, that said, that's not my concern that Mitt Romney was against him. My concern is I just don't think Mitt Romney is geared for what needs to be done at the State Department. I mean, we need an agent of change in there because of all that has been flowing through there in the last 8 years. This administration has used the State Department to pump out this liberal ideology only to have it come back into the United States through the back door of the UN. And we've got to have somebody who will stop that, reverse it, turn it around, and change it.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that, whether it has been Kellyanne Conway or Newt Gingrich or others who have been with the president-elect throughout this campaign, basically they are saying, you want a distinct, Trump footprint. And anything that, in the geopolitical sand, and anything that distracts from that, anything that sends confusion or a mixed message is counterproductive. And so that's why you see these folks just stepping up and speaking out.
Wow.
And I've watched him now enough to know that he is not discouraging, that sort of transparency and open vetting, the sort of team of rivals approach. He'll make the decision consistent with what he knows that he promised the people that he would get done.
All right. Well, we've got to leave it there, Ken. We'll be watching closely. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony. Thanks for all you do.
All right. Ken Blackwell, an amazing American. He's everywhere. All right. When we come back, researcher on Snuggies, robe-style blankets, and a study on Shakespeare. Top the annual government wasteful spending list. Senator James Lankford is here. Don't go away.
Announcing Jonah Had a Whale of a Time. Random true stories to encourage and inspire by J.J. Jasper.
Trying to write with a broken pencil is pointless.
From the author of the best-selling book Moses Was a Basket Case comes the much-anticipated sequel Jonah Had a Whale of a Time. With more of the same brand of humor that makes J.J. fun to listen to and to read.
If you're from a dysfunctional background, consider this. Every baby chicken came from a broken home.
American Family Radio President Tim Wildman calls J.J. Jasper a gifted storyteller.
He's a gifted storyteller.
And Tim says get two copies, one for yourself and one for a friend who needs to be inspired.
My wife told me to stop impersonating flamingos. so I had to put my foot down.
It's Jonah had a whale of a time. While supplies last, for a suggested donation of just $15.99 at afastore.net or call 877-927-4917.
This message is provided by Liberty HealthShare.
You can control your health care with Liberty HealthShare.
Liberty HealthShare gives you freedom from health insurance.
You can finally make the right decisions for you and your family.
It's not insurance, it's medical cost sharing.
You can affordably control the cost of your medical expenses.
It's a group of individuals sharing the cost of health care. This is based on shared values.
You are not alone.
With Liberty HealthShare, you're part of something bigger. A group of people who care for and support one another.
Join the movement of people who share in medical costs and change the way you pay for your health care forever.
It's easy. Visit healthsharefamily.org right now. healthsharefamily.org. Enroll today.
Liberty HealthShare.
Together, we're changing health care for good. Check out healthsharefamily.org. healthsharefamily.org. Not available in Pennsylvania.
Who says you can't have your cake and eat it too? If you're like a lot of people, you would like to support the culture-changing efforts of the American Family Association. But there's the very pressing reality that your income must meet your current needs as well as act as seed for future income, either for the short term or for life. A charitable gift annuity might be your answer. A charitable gift annuity offers a unique method for both planning ahead for permanent income and supporting the work of the American Family Association. An AFA Foundation representative will walk you through the details of creating a charitable gift annuity, allowing you to decide if a charitable gift annuity is right for your individual financial situation. Connect with us today by calling 800-326-4543, extension 345, or visit us online at afafoundation.net.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins. Glad to have you with us on this Tuesday afternoon. A new report is out on how the federal government spends your tax dollars. I don't know if you want to hear this, but you should. Oklahoma Senator James Lankford is here. He produced the report, what he calls Federal Fumbles. This is a listing of, well, quite frankly, what the federal government should not be doing with your money. Senator James Lankford, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Hey, glad to be with you again, Tony.
Well, I am glad somebody is doing it. At least it keeps it at the forefront of what the federal government is doing that it should not be doing in terms of misusing our tax dollars. But what tops the list this year of your compilation of these federal fumbles?
So we really break it out into three areas. As you know, we're breaking it out into areas of federal government where they're wasting our money, where they're not doing what they should do with our money, and also when they're also doing regulations that they shouldn't do. And so it really taps into all areas of just federal government not doing its job well. We have areas as large as Medicaid, $142 billion in what is called improper payments, $30 billion from the USDA in improper payments that are not being managed well. And then we also break it down into areas that may be much smaller, but where the NIH, for instance, did a study of 5 to 8-year-old children to see if they minded eating food that someone had sneezed on, and we spent $2 million on testing that. So we did grants, we did spending, we did all areas, trying to get a good synopsis of it. By no means is it exhaustive of every area, but it gave an example of the type of things that we've got to be able to solve.
Now, in summary, you have identified about $247 billion in what is called wasteful and inefficient federal spending. You know, before too long, that actually becomes real money. I mean, $247 billion, that's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money. And that deals with, you know, the biggest of those, the Medicaid program with all the improper payments with Medicaid, which has topped the list for years of being one of the primary areas, and some of its smaller areas. There was a $500,000 grant that the National Science Foundation did to be able to do a research study to be able to examine on climate change and glacier changes, where you should study changes in glaciers from a feminist point of view rather than just from a science point of view. So we did a $500,000 study on feminism and glaciers.
Well, I'm not going to touch that one. $500,000 to study on a program to send text messages to discourage using tobacco.
That's correct.
Was that while people were smoking while they were driving and sending text messages, or what?
Well, no, it was actually simpler than that even. It's, they were trying to identify people in rural areas that use chewing tobacco, they were sending them messages while they were trying to use chewing tobacco to discourage them from doing that. So I guess it's the one step beyond. There's a warning label on the actual product itself. They wanted to actually give them another text message while they're using the product to try to discourage them from using it as well. $500,000 for that project.
When all that adds up, it'll make you spit mad when you see how much money they're wasting. Let me ask you this, because I know that this is one of the questions that our listeners are going to be asking themselves. All right, you've been doing this now. You picked this up from Senator Tom Coburn when he left. You've taken it over. He was the former senator from Oklahoma. You now have taken this on each year, putting out this annual list of what you call the federal fumbles, showing the inefficiencies and the wasteful spending. Are you hopeful that under a Trump administration that actually this annual report is going to shrink because some of this is going to be addressed?
Well, that is my hope. We're at about $3.5 trillion of federal spending every year, so there's no way to be able to solve all of it. The only way to make government more efficient is to make it smaller and to make it local. When you make it smaller and local, it becomes more efficient every time. But in absence of that, we can eliminate programs, we can simplify programs, we can pay more attention to it. But what I try to do with all 100 of these items was to not just list a complaint, but also the solution. How do you solve it? All 100 of these have a solution, either an administrative solution that we will work with the Trump administration to be able to solve, or a legislative solution that we're going to try to work through over the next year. Some of them we had last year, we had a list of 100 we were able to have some success on. For instance, one of the areas we listed last year was wind subsidies. Wind subsidies started 25 years ago when wind power was new, and they just stayed and grew bigger and bigger every year. Wind power does not need a subsidy anymore. Every year it's a $6 billion subsidy just to subsidize wind power in America. We finally got that wound down last year. So there are some areas where we identify that we are able to get rid of, and we try to identify that in the book as well. So we don't just give people the discouragement.
Right.
We give them the optimism of knowing there is a solution to this, and we show them progress from the previous years to say we are still working these things through.
Well, Senator Langford, a large portion of this is just bringing it to light and letting people know that this is happening, because a lot of this stuff is slipped in last minute. People don't know about it. In fact, unless somebody digs through it, it'll never be known except for the recipients of the money.
That's correct. Well, there's about $650 billion a year that is done in federal grants. These are from all the different agencies. Very little oversight over those grants. Most agencies have a very simple process for giving that money away. It's not their money. It's tax dollars. And so it's a simplified, streamlined process to get it out. But $650 billion is more than we spend on national defense. That's going out the door in grants. And many of these silly things that you see out there, like a $2 million test to be able to examine whether children will eat food that's been sneezed on, or a grant that was given to British citizens to be able to come to the United States to watch American volunteers and they could learn more about volunteering, those grants need more oversight.
Yeah.
So we're trying to work through that process as well.
Without question. Senator, thanks so much for shining a light on it. We'll encourage people to take a look at the report as we help push it out there so taxpayers see where their money is going.
Yeah, can do. It's just on our website, langford.senate.gov.
All right. Senator James Langford, thanks so much for being with us.
You bet. Glad to do it, Tony.
Folks, it's helpful, but hopeful that now that we have an administration that has promised to be responsible and resourceful, that we'll see a lot of this eliminated. But my hat's off to Senator, in my personal hat, I paid for it, not taxpayers. My hat's off to Senator James Langford for bringing greater awareness to this. By the way, you can find out more. Go to the website, TonyPerkins.com. Follow links over. Also, if you're not receiving my daily update tomorrow, Our team will be kind of doing an in-depth analysis. They have a lot of fun with the Waste Book as we take a look at where your tax dollars are going. So if you're not getting my update, go to the website, TonyPerkins.com, and sign up so you can get that tomorrow. All right, when we come back, Dr. Gary Gregg is here to talk about the Electoral College. Don't go away.
Making the most of your money. Here's Dan Celia.
Well, GDP number came out. This is the second look at the third quarter of GDP. According to the Commerce Department, gross domestic product expanded 3.2%. Now, remember, they were expecting 3%. This should, and I say should, have a positive impact on the markets moving forward because this is good organic growth economic story, if, of course, it is truly accurate. This is a very good quarter. We'll have to wait to see now what fourth quarter looks like and what the annual pace of growth might be. Could this be, in the eighth year of his presidency, the year President Obama has 1 year of growth over 2%? That's not saying much. 2.3%, by the way, if that were to hold true, would be a pretty good annual pace. I'd take 3% if we could get it. And if it's accurate and real. But remember, it's hard to believe that we could have this kind of growth and still stay mired in 1978 as far as labor participation. We need people coming back into the workforce to at least give us some confirmation that, wow, the GDP and the growth rate really is picking up. I don't see that just yet, but we'll hold out some hope for the fourth quarter.
Want to hear more financial advice from Dan Celia? Then look for his podcast when you visit the website afr.net.
You are listening to Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins. Glad to have you with us on this Tuesday afternoon. A little overcast here in D.C., a little bit of rain. Warm, but rainy. All right, for the first time in U.S. history and the second time this century, a presidential candidate has won the White House while losing the popular vote. President-elect Trump's victory of 306 electoral votes has given new energy to the Electoral College debate. Joining us now is Gary Gregg II, Ph.D. He is the Mitch McConnell Chair in Leadership and Director of the McConnell Center at the University of Louisville, an author, political commentator, and he is an expert on the Electoral College. One of his books is entitled Securing Democracy, Why We Have the Electoral College. Dr. Gregg, welcome to Washington Watch.
Hey, thanks, Tony. Thanks for having me.
All right. The reason I wanted to have you on, you're an expert in this topic, and a lot of questions being raised about popular vote, the challenging of the popular vote in some of these states, and, of course, with Donald Trump appearing to not have gained the popular vote, but the electoral vote total, putting him over the top. People are saying, why do we have the Electoral College? Should we not change it? So I want you to help us separate fact from fiction. First, let's start with the reason we have the Electoral College.
Yeah, well, the first thing I'd say, Tony, is as much as I like to argue in favor of the founders' visions of things, you can't really defend the Electoral College today, the way it operates today, with the way the founders intended, because what they wanted was a deliberative body that met in the states that would discuss good candidates for president and would keep us from a world where we've largely fallen into, I think, where we have these big campaigns of sort of demagoguery and throwing around political charges and the public, getting all the public all excited. And they wanted that to be a deliberative process. That's not what we have, however. What we have is a democratic process. It's perfectly democratic. It's just a way of counting. It's a way of counting the democratic votes by state. But that has important impact, and some of which the founders intended, including being focused on the states and reinforcing federalism, which it does.
which is very similar to the Senate, having the Senate. The Senate plays a very similar role in kind of being the what they would call the saucer of the teacup that allows things to settle over there in the Senate. It represents the states. Originally, the Senate members were selected by the state legislatures, even more representative of the states. But it was to give all the states equal footing, and the Electoral College does something very similar to that.
Yeah, it gives a little offset. You know, some of the opponents decry it as some big anti-democratic force. It's not. Small states get a little bit of offset against the big states, but they're treated as important entities in the political system. And I think that's a very important role that the Electoral College helps play.
Without the college, what we could potentially have, could it not be we have like New York and California, two very populous states, pretty much dictating the outcome of federal elections?
Yeah, that's what I fear. Let's be clear on all the discussion of Secretary Clinton winning the popular vote. There was never a race to win the popular vote. Donald Trump never tried to win California, never went to California, didn't try to win New York seriously, was in there because he lived there. But so this is really a myth that this doesn't really matter that in the system electoral system to try to get 270 votes, one candidate got the popular vote. That really doesn't matter. But secondly, is if you look at the way Secretary Clinton won the popular vote, she won the popular vote completely on the back of California. She'll win somewhere around 2.2 million votes nationally, more than Trump, but she won 3-point-some million more votes just in California. So she really lost the entire country but won California. And almost did so just by winning L.A. She'll win somewhere between 1.2 and 1.5 million more votes than Trump just in L.A. And so, yes, I think if you remove the Electoral College, what I think happens is candidates will sink down into L.A. And Philadelphia and New York and Washington, D.C. and Chicago and Detroit. And those small states, those rural voters, those hunters and those farmers out here will never be heard from again in the presidential election.
So basically 95% of the country becomes flyover country.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right.
All right. Let me, Dr. Gray, get to this question. Let's talk about the meeting of the Electoral College and the discussion that goes on there. Can they go differently than what their states voted? There's some people saying that they're going to reject Donald Trump as the president. What are the prospects there?
Yeah, I think it's not likely to happen in any serious way. You know, you had an elector in Texas just yesterday or the day before say that he's resigning his position. So he's not actually going to vote the other way, just resigning his position because he doesn't want to vote for Trump. But the electors can vote their conscience. It was set up by the founders so that they would vote their conscience. That's actually the core of what the Electoral College is supposed to be about. And it's all dictated by states, though. So some states have rules and will punish electors if they vote differently. Some don't. But I don't think it's going to be a big problem to worry about.
So your prediction is Donald Trump gets the 306 electoral votes that he has won according to the voting thus far?
If not, certainly over 300 if he loses one or two perhaps there, but that'll be it.
All right. Dr. Gary Gregg, thanks so much for joining us. Insightful, interesting, and I appreciate you sharing it with us.
Thank you, Tony.
All right, Dr. Gary Gregg. To find out more, go to the website, tonyperkins.com. There you have it, folks. Fact from fiction. It's the way it works, and all these theories going on out there that Donald Trump might be robbed of the election through the Electoral College, not likely to happen. All right, when we come back, our good friend Joel Rosenberg here from Israel joins me in the studio. Don't go away. We're right back after this.
We all know what it feels like. We try to avoid it. Experts define it as an unpleasant sensory and emotional experience associated with actual or potential tissue damage, or describes in terms of such damage. What is it? It's pain. Did you realize that you probably started feeling pain at a very young age, or even before you were born? Scientific studies have increased our knowledge of life inside the womb. We now have strong evidence that unborn babies can feel pain by 20 weeks or earlier. At Family Research Council, we believe that all babies are worth protecting. We also hope that even those who don't share our pro-life commitment will listen to the medical community and support laws that protect the unborn child from cruel suffering. For more information, visit frc.org/fetal pain. That is frc.org/fetal pain.
Consider serving the Lord with friendships. It's an opportunity to reach out to the needy around the world. They're now taking applications to volunteer, and they need help in the areas of mechanics, maritime, including deck, engine, and steward departments, food service, warehousing, and office. Check it out at friendships.org or call 337-433-5022.
The gay agenda, Islam, liberation theology, aggressive socialism. You ask yourself, how should I respond to these attacks on my Christian faith? How can I share Christ in a sinful culture? Hello, I'm John Nyhoff, president of Wesley Biblical Seminary in Jackson, Mississippi. An online Master of Arts in Apologetics from WBS will prepare you to defend and share your faith in an increasingly hostile world. Wesley Biblical Seminary, where faith and learning challenge culture. WBS.edu.
Franklin Graham, president of Samaritan's Purse.
We've got an incredible program after Operation Christmas Child. It's called The Greatest Journey.
With your help, Samaritan's Purse is going into all the world with their discipleship program called The Greatest Journey.
We always work through the local church. And when it's all said and done and the training's finished, these kids are going to be part of the church, going out into their communities, sharing their faith in Jesus Christ.
Here's Chris Swanson of Operation Christmas Child.
Giving The Greatest Journey to a child is easy. Just $6 provides everything. All the materials, including a trained teacher for a child to attend class and become a faithful disciple.
American Family Radio has set a goal to provide The Greatest Journey to 12,000 children. Won't you help with a donation? $6 trains one child. $60 trains 10. And with a donation of $150, you can provide discipleship for 25 children. Call today at 877-616-2396 or visit afr.net.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins. Glad you're with us. The website, TonyPerkins.com. If you're on Twitter, it's at TPerkins. A lot happening. I want to encourage you to sign up for my daily update and our alerts because stuff's happening on such a fast pace. We're in a lame duck session of Congress, hopeful that that lame duck's not going to be quacking too much because Donald Trump's around the corner in promising to eliminate any bad stuff. And so anyway, we're hoping Congress gets out of town. But until then, we have to be on alert. So we need you to respond. You were very critical in this election, responding to messages that we put out. Very important in this past congressional year, which ended up not being too bad of a year. But you played a key part of that. So it needs you to be informed and engaged. And to help you do that, we've got a lot of resources. Alerts, daily update, various resources as well at the website, TonyPerkins.com. So head on over there and sign up. All right. While we continue to prepare for a Trump administration here in the United States, looking forward to January, what does the idea of a Trump administration look like to those in the Middle East, a place in the world that has become very unstable during the last 8 years of Barack Obama? In fact, let's look specifically to Israel, a long time ally of the United States, which has, I would say, been neglected by this administration. How have the Israelis looked upon this election of Donald Trump? Well, we need not guess because we have someone here who can help us with the answer. Joel Rosenberg, an American communication strategist, New York Times bestselling author, and an Israeli citizen. As well as an American citizen. Joel Rosenberg.
Dual citizen. I meant I got to vote twice.
Well, you could live in Chicago.
Not twice here, but exactly. Once there, once
well,
here.
Welcome back. Thank you, welcome Tony. Back to the FRC headquarters here in Washington. Welcome back to the States. Good to see you again.
It's great to be back in the United States, and I'm very thankful. This has been a very happy Thanksgiving, one just to be with family and friends, and but also thankful that the United States dodged a bullet.
We dodged a nuclear warhead.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair.
Well, look, you and I have had a number of discussions offline
right.
During the this election cycle.
Yes.
You were not a
Just say it right out. Yeah. I was never Trump.
Yeah.
Until the final week.
Yeah.
And that was very hard for me to change.
And so you were not so never Trump.
That's true. And I had to. I realized that if I was going to send an absentee ballot from Israel to the United States to vote for the Trump-Pence ticket, that I owed at least those who read my blog a reason. You know, I mean, not just to do that in the shadows. And for me, it was – I said very clearly, it really now is a binary choice. For me, it wasn't in the primaries. You had 17 choices,
oh, yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
And then
I'm with you.
I was a stop him and look at his record. Okay. But then we got to the convention and I thought, well, maybe there's a way that he could be stopped, and it didn't happen. And then when the video came out, the vulgar video in the fall, I was like, I can't even consider. I'm a family research, focus on the family type person. I just can't do it. And I hoped that he would step aside and let Pence continue on, and it didn't happen. And so once you get down to a week before and you think, okay, we know, you could read the two platforms. You look at – and I know. I've spent most of my professional life working against the Clintons when I was research director right. for Rush Limbaugh and working – anyway, on and on. So I had to vote against her, and I decided, you know, personally, I know Mike Pence and Karen well, personal friends with them. And so I thought, you know what? I can't say for certain who Trump will be, but if he's chosen Pence, that's a good sign. I see evangelicals like yourself having access and having his ear. So I know for certain what we'll get with Clinton.
Right.
And I don't know what for certain, but I will have to take the chance. And
I think that's where
we are.
Well,
what I didn't expect was that blog. I mean, it's just a blog. Went viral. 1.25 million people read it in 4 days. And I think a lot of people were like where I was.
No question. Yeah. No question that people were troubled by this, and that was a part of this process, was walking people through this. And you mentioned a couple of key points, Joel, that I think – well, I don't think I know, based upon exit polling showed, post-election polling, 59% of those that supported Trump said that the party platform and its strong position on life and religious liberty were key factors in their presidential choice.
Huge factors.
So it really came down to, you said, the platform. You compared the two platforms. There could not have been a sharper contrast between the two.
Light and darkness.
And so people vote. Many Christians voted for the platform. They voted – you know, what was interesting for me was this started out as an election on personalities, two very big, well-known personalities.
Yeah.
No discussion. I was so frustrated with the lack of discussion of policy, of hard and fast ideas and policy prescriptions. But in the end, this was an election about policy.
It was.
It was the parties putting forth the policies, but both candidates wrapped themselves in their respective platforms.
And it was interesting because the biggest decision that we could actually see during that process by Mr. Trump was the Pence selection. And
that was
quite dramatic
telling,
because he had a lot of other options, which some of which would have been like, well, okay, but wouldn't have been like, wow. Now that says a lot. So I think that one of the things that happened between – I mean I wrote two columns early in the year, 2016 – one was the 39 reasons why Hillary Clinton would be a catastrophe for the country. These were just straight, direct links to her quotes and policy proposals and votes over the years. But I also admittedly had written 39 reasons why he would be a catastrophe. You look at those quotes and some of the things he'd been saying, it's pretty bad. But what happened between January, February, and now? You got the platform. You had Pence's decision. You had advisors coming around him that you could see he was listening to. I mean,
you had the court list.
You had the court list was huge. That's the next one I was going to go with. You had a list of people we've never. I can't remember in my lifetime, and I think it never happened, right? Because I'm 49, and I don't think people were putting out Supreme Court lists before me.
Well, there's
an
never,
actual list that you'd say that's what he's saying he's going to do. Now then it becomes a question of trust. But if you know what you're going to get from her and you say, wow, these are actually a pretty good – I'm not sure every list person on that list I'm comfortable with.
No.
But it's a pretty good list.
And he has said –
And it can be tested against what he does.
And he has unequivocally said repeatedly that he was going to nominate pro-life judges. We've never had a Republican nominee that has said that.
Well, and then you had the debates, some of which you'd like, oh, my gosh. I mean, it was watching a train wreck.
Painful.
However, there were moments. There were moments on life, partial birth abortion.
I was
there. Were some things that you think, I've never seen some of the people that I would consider some of the best Republican conservative candidates ever run that have been that willing to talk about these things.
And he did it in his own words.
Yeah.
I was there. I was sitting on the ninth row watching that debate. And I knew at that point he had basically closed the deal with evangelicals because – you could tell in – you know the way Trump talks. He talks, I don't know, differently. He uses strings of adjectives in different – I mean, it's just interesting. But it was clear that that had not been given to him in some kind of prescriptive description to use of partial birth abortion or late-term abortion. He talked about it in his own words, which was very convincing.
It was. So – But it was convincing to the extent that you say, if I'm making a choice, the question now is, since it can't be her, I'm either voting for him or I'm not. And if I'm not, then it becomes, well, then I am helping her. And look, I have people who didn't go past. They were never Trumpers and they stuck there. And I don't believe they were sellouts any more than I believe the people who voted for Trump was a sellout. I believe there was a battle because I was feeling it. I was experiencing it. It was a battle of competing convictions. Now, I'm sure there's some people who are, from making decisions for all kinds of other reasons. But at the core, I think you had people struggling with what's the right conviction as a believer to elevate when you don't have a lot to say, well, there's the evidence that I can be sure that what I'm hearing is what I'm going to get.
But it's also a process of logical, following the choices through logically and knowing what the outcomes are going to be. And part of that just comes with experience of being in the city and knowing how the dominoes fall and what's going to happen. Joel Rosenberg, I want to move on, though, because I want to talk about how this election is being perceived in Israel and what has been the response there in terms of their anticipation of an incoming Trump administration?
Well, it was, of course, a shock because just as it was a shock for any of the media here in the United States, for the entire center left of the country who was convinced by the New York Times that there was a 90% chance that she was going to become the next president of the United States, you can imagine if you're far away in a very volatile region that has a few other issues on the table.
Of course, you didn't have to stay up late at night either.
No, we got to wake up early and watch. It was quite interesting. No, but you had every leader and every intelligence analyst and every general who was waking up who was going to try to figure out what does this look like. They pretty much had gone to bed reasonably convinced that they were planning for a Clinton administration, which for whatever they thought of that – they had some experience. They've seen Bill Clinton.
Right.
They've seen her. She was the Secretary of State. They all know her, and they know they could prepare, right or wrong, good or bad. They weren't dealing with the life issue. They weren't dealing with transgender. They're dealing with how is the United States going to be an ally.
But she was a part of the administration that negotiated the Iran nuclear deal.
Well, absolutely. So right, there was a lot of concern about her, but there was a knowledge base and a personal relationship base that everybody had. Now, what's interesting is in Israel, right? So I just was at a conference just the day before Thanksgiving, right before I flew back here. I was 400 diplomats, ambassadors to Israel, defense attachés, military attachés, diplomatic staff. So it was a conference held by the Jerusalem Post, the main English language paper in the country, for foreign diplomats to hear from the prime minister, the defense minister, and the top leadership, including the opposition. So somehow I got invited. So that was interesting because it was the first on-the-record discussions we've heard of what are the Israelis thinking. It's very striking. They're being very cautious. They don't want to say anything that's you know, going to make a lot of news. But a few observations. First, it's important to remember that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli premier, has a personal relationship with Trump. Trump actually had cut a TV ad for Netanyahu several years ago when Netanyahu was running for prime minister. Trump as a businessman and as a larger-than-life American figure actually had such deep resonance in Israel that him cutting an ad was considered a positive. So this is because they've got a long-standing relationship. Right. What's interesting about Netanyahu's speech was not that he talked about Trump, but was he talked about how optimistic he is for the future. Israel's future, the future of the U.S.-Israel relationship. Reading between the lines, you and I were at the speech that Netanyahu gave to the joint session of Congress over the Iran issue, and we were there. We recall the president, you know, being so against that, not willing to send top officials to meet with Netanyahu on that trip. Essentially, the boycotting of our main ally on a critical issue. So I think part of Netanyahu's optimism, if you look between the lines, is the possibility that there's really going to be a friend in the office.
Well, now, not only do you have Donald Trump, but Mike Pence as vice president is a staunch supporter.
Well, that's right. And now I think that the big question that Israel and the Jordanians and the Egyptians and everyone else in the region has is, okay, now who is he going to staff himself with, right? So you're looking at the Secretary of State position. That's obviously a big brouhaha going on over who that is. Defense, unless it got named in the last few hours, I think we're right now looking at General Mattis. We'll see. So you're watching to see the national security team come together because these are the people that the Israelis and our Sunni Arab allies will be dealing with really. And then you're going to have to watch – this is the big thing everyone's watching. How will Trump handle allies, right? Because he's raised a very interesting question in NATO. Are they going to pay their fair share? Are they up for the challenge? We're not just going to send troops and money and material if they're not willing to do their fair share. Now the Israelis, that's not a direct impact, or the Jordanians or the Egyptians. But again, you're watching – how will Trump move from being a businessman to being the leader of the free world? And you've got Putin, a real risk that he is going to try to do something, move into the Baltics, move into Ukraine, do things that and strike while there's confusion and transition. I'm not saying that's necessarily what's going to happen, but we're going to watch to see.
Have you written a book about it?
I'm researching one right now.
Because if you write it, it usually happens.
Well, I don't know. I'm not trying to write things to make them happen, but to warn what would happen.
Yeah.
I think Trump's raising an important question, which has a Middle East impact as it does in Europe, which is what is America's interests? Who are our allies? And how will we work together to accomplish those in this new era? And I don't think we know that yet.
Yeah, a lot of unanswered questions that, we'll get to see firsthand how Donald Trump addresses those issues. And I look forward to a strong relationship with Israel. Joel Rosenberg, thanks so much for being with us.
Great to be with you, Tony. Thank you.
All right, folks, out of time, but I want to thank you for being with us today. To find out more, go to tonyperkins.com. Until next time, I leave you with the encouraging words of the Apostle Paul, found in Ephesians 6, where he says, when you've done everything you can do, when you've prayed, prepared, and taken your stand, by all means, keep standing.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is a production of the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. For more information on anything you heard today, or if you'd like to find out how you can support the ongoing efforts of the Family Research Council, visit tonyperkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our new watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.